Welcome to another edition of American Countdown. This Thursday, April 30th, 2020. Day 30, day 25, day 35, day 55, depending on where you are in the world, of the shutdown of American civil society and public economy. Tonight, resolve that the post-pandemic economy may not look anything like the pre-pandemic economy. We may be seeing food shortages. We may see oil collapse. We may see the central banks take over large shares of the U.S. economy, take over large shares of the world economy. We may see inflation. We may see deflation. We may see stagflation. We may see a mixture of all three. Tonight, we'll be discussing that later on with George Gammon, who has been prescient in his predictions, both with his guest and with himself over the last month and a half. We'll be discussing that and more. Just to give you some of the economic headlines. Coronavirus outbreak. It's not the outbreak that's causing the problems. It's, in fact, the shutdown primarily and principally that's causing the problems. That plus the supply chain issues is squeezing Pennsylvania's food supply chain. Indeed, the president was having to issue orders, emergency orders, to take over parts of the food supply chain for the first time in American history just to make sure we can have meat in the coming weeks. In the same context, articles talking about what comes next for the stock market and the equities market depends on one key uncertainty, and that's whether or not these shutdowns will be lifted and how soon they will be lifted and the scope and scale to which they will be lifted. Today, Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama mostly lifted their shutdowns, but not entirely. California doubled down. Maine doubled down. Michigan is attempting to double down. Illinois is attempting to double down. Large parts of the U.S. economy still suppressing all economic activity and civil liberties. Indeed, other problems include money velocity. That's the speed with which money goes in around the economy. That dictates whether you get deflation or inflation or stable pricing. Well, in that context, an article reads, Americans are hoarding cash. Savings rate hits the highest level since 1981. In other words, the money people are getting, because they are nervous about the future of the economy, they're hoarding rather than spending. That hoarding habit was a key function in the Depression extending over a decade when it happened in 1929. Another article in Poverty and Social Policy Brief about how forecasting estimates of poverty during the COVID-19 crisis. And what it goes through, it says employment rates are projected, in fact, to rise to 30%. The annual poverty rate may go up to 20%, which would be the highest level of poverty since 1967. Even if employment recovers, they project an annual poverty rate that will be higher than any time in the modern era. They suggest that, in fact, there's also the pre-tax, pre-transfer poverty rates will reach a record high, they estimate, this year. Working age adults and children will face particularly large increases in poverty. And with poverty globally comes starvation. Estimates are that up to 130 million people, more than normal, will be on the edge of starvation this year because of the global economic shutdown. In the same context, as was written today at Real Clear Markets, the pandemic is over. Let's stop the economic suicide and get back to work. Going through the details of how the devastating effects of economic suppression are far worse than anything the pandemic could have brought. That includes in terms of quality of health care. One of the parts of the economy that has completely collapsed is the health care part of the economy. The economy is not just a matter of stocks and 401ks and IRAs and wages. The economy is how we shelter one another. The economy is how we feed one another. The economy is how we protect our national security and provide for safety. The economy is how we care for one another, both in material terms and in medical terms. Without it, the core of the functions of civil society itself falls apart. And that's what is happening. Indeed, as an article in GNSE Economics talks about the stages of the collapse, and how what's happening and what we're seeing in the global markets, what we're seeing in the regular everyday economy, is the sign of an unparalleled, unprecedented collapse in global economics. Indeed, something that we did not even see during the global depression. That is how bad it is going to be. As another article is written in American Mind, titled, To Hell with Main Street? Showing about how much of the policies, bailout policies to date, primarily and principally by the Federal Reserve, but also being filtered through the banks. Remember, the SBA loan stimulus package that was passed is being filtered through the banks. The banks have actually already being sued in Illinois in class actions because they favored the privileged few. They gave it to their big customers, to their, they provided concierge services to their highest end corporate customers, ignoring ordinary small businesses on Main Street. Indeed, by there's multiple levels at which Main Street is getting shafted in this stimulus and economic package. And that, in fact, was a discussion of a YouTube video by George Gammon, who will be our guest tonight as well. So Main Street is not getting the relief they need. People are unemployment checks are coming late. Those that are getting unemployment or stimulus checks are hoarding the cash rather than spending it. And this can have a trickle-down effect on the rest of the economy. Indeed, and various governments are already worried about whether or not people will be willing to buy their bonds. To give an example, the Fed has bought more treasuries in the last 6 weeks than they did in the prior 6 years. But what's happening in India? India is now issuing sovereign gold bonds in order to get people to buy their treasuries, in order to get people to pay for all of these things the governments are trying to now spend as a substitute for a real economy, what's sometimes called modern monetary theory or helicopter money. That because people don't trust that these governments will pay them back, even a government as substantial and perceived to be as secure as India is already having to issue gold-backed bonds in order to get people to have any confidence in buying those bonds. And buying those bonds is essential for the debt financing almost every government around the world needs. Indeed, it's so bad in the oil economy. Not only are we seeing food shortages, such that the president has to intervene to try to prevent them, we're also seeing oil collapse, particularly in the United States. Part of this is a function of Saudi Arabia and Russia increasing production and trying to drive down the shale U.S. oil economy, but that's only part of it. The other part of it is that the shutdown has completely wiped out oil demand in the country. And that is why the U.S. is now talking about buying equity stakes in U.S. energy companies. In other words, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, either together or separately, are talking about buying stocks. That's called nationalization. That's what they have in Venezuela. That's what they have in Mexico. That's what they have in parts of Russia. So they're talking about the government owning oil supply, the government owning these companies, the government buying these companies. That's what buying stocks is. In fact, the Federal Reserve has been doing some version of that directly or indirectly for the last 6 weeks, effectively shoring up and securing corporate debt, including now in different countries around the world buying junk bonds. That central banks are now buying junk bonds. That's where we are in this shutdown-driven post-pandemic economy. Meanwhile, there's a lot of jobs that are simply never going to come back. That even if they relift the economy, take away the shutdown orders, there's places that just won't reopen. Indeed, as this headline describes from Restaurant Business Online, a lot of restaurants are already permanently closed. These are places that will never reopen, including restaurants that have been around 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. Most small businesses do not have the reserves to withstand a month-long shutdown. And so some of those restaurants are gone and done forever. Indeed, as this headline reveals from prospect.org, we have a return of the breadline. We see long lines in L.A., Houston, and other places across the country for people trying to get food from food banks, trying to get charity food. And not only that, the food banks report they're running out of food. So that's the scale and scope. A breadline we haven't seen since the Great Depression is now coming back to the U.S. economy today. In the same way, the millions of orchards are being thrown out by a top world exporter. The entire flower market is collapsing. The flower market not only supports people here in the United States, but is often critical to economies in Africa and other parts of the world, where a collapse of that flower economy could collapse their local economy and dramatically increase poverty, starvation, and political turmoil, as is already happening in Lebanon and other parts of the world. Indeed, the shale suffering as to oil has only just begun, according to oilprice.com. We may be seeing more and more problems in the oil economy than we could have ever imagined before. Meanwhile, we have things like the governor of California shutting down beaches because he didn't like how many people are out there. This is despite more and more evidence, including this study, and continuing to keep schools closed at the same time. Two major studies that came out, one that said sunshine was within 2 minutes, it could wipe out the ability of COVID-19 to spread. So we know open air is a great disinfectant for the ability of this virus to spread. We know that people that are not very close to each other can't allow this COVID-19 to spread. And in the same context, we know now sunshine, heat, and humidity are good to defeat the spread of the virus. Despite that, they're shutting down beaches. So the, in fact, one doctor said the best place in the world to be to defeat this virus, to avoid the spread of this virus, the transmission of this virus, is on a beach between the wind, between the heat, between the humidity, between the sunlight, but all between being outdoors and open air. There's nothing that's more effective. More studies that confirm that. And yet we have politicians shutting down beaches. There's no rational basis anymore for a lot of these shutdown orders. In the same context, we continue to keep schools closed, even though a study both with about SARS virus, which is similar to this virus, in the same context, they've now done studies about this virus, and they find that not only do children not get affected by this, not only do they not suffer from the disease of COVID-19, but in fact, children disproportionately, very few of them ever spread the disease at all. So it turns out we shut down schools for no purpose. As this article described in The Lancet, a medical article about the SARS virus, the title is School Closure and Management Practices During Coronavirus Outbreaks, Including COVID-19, A Systematic Review. And what they show is that, in fact, closing down schools did nothing to reduce the transmission of the virus, did nothing to suppress the transmission and the spread of the virus. And in fact, all it actually does is cause other problems, sticking children at home in isolation, depriving them of education, depriving them of association, depriving them of access to grandparents, a whole bunch of other things that have no benefit, not to mention locking in victims with their abusers in many instances, such that we have a rise, a spike in domestic violence reports, a spike in child abuse reports. That's what this shutdown is producing. And at the same time, of course, that's not all. The inevitable coronavirus censorship crisis is here, according to Matt Taibbi, someone who's more on the left, but is pointing out that the way YouTube and big tech are using their collective aggregate powers to suppress independent information is effectively bringing Big Brother back and the Ministry of Truth from Orwell's 1984 back to where 2020 increasingly looks like 1984. That maybe we should retitle COVID-19, COVID-1984, with the kind of policies our various politicians and big tech gatekeepers are imposing on the West. Indeed, as even The Economist recognized, they said the autocrats see opportunity in disaster. That in fact, the effect of this is that there's a pandemic of power grab politicians, and that is the truest threat to the future of the quality of life for people in the West. Indeed, as a classic example and illustration of that, consider this headline. A Kentucky family of seven didn't practice social distancing, according to the government. So now Child Services, as was predicted on this show, is investigating the parents for abuse. They're now threatening to take people's kids away. In fact, there was police officers who showed up at somebody's home because they let their daughter stay at a neighbor's home. That's what's happening. If you don't behave in the way the people in the white lab coats tell you to, they're going to take away your kids. Not only can they arrest you, cite you, threaten you, fine you, punish you, now they're going to investigate you and take away your children. That's the scope and scale and severity of the insanity of what we are facing with these shutdown policies and politics. In the same vein, that's the atmosphere in which we face. Well, let's take a look, for example, at some of the food issues that are taking place across the country. And let's take a look at video clip number 5, as American farmers are being ordered to destroy livestock. So the creating and festering and increasing the problem we have with the food supply. Let's play clip number 5.
Chad Sullivan, regional director of RCALF USA, is a fifth-generation Colorado rancher and recently delivered this message.
Hey, everybody. This is Chad Sullivan coming to you from the headwaters of Bitter Creek, Archer County, North Texas. We have to talk. State officials will be assisting to help identify potential alternative markets if a producer is unable to move animals, and if necessary, advise and assist on depopulation and disposal methods. Ladies and gentlemen, we are plowing under vegetable crops from coast to coast. We are euthanizing millions of chickens. We are aborting sows and burying feeder pigs. We are dumping milk by the hundreds of thousands of gallons, and now they are preparing us to depopulate the fat cattle ready to harvest because of a bottleneck created by the effects of COVID. This thing hasn't been created by COVID, but the effects of COVID and the logistics therein. Yesterday, the first shipment of imported beef from the country of Namibia hit the shores of the United States of America. And yet this morning, they are telling us to prepare to euthanize harvest-ready cattle. It is time we get food on the shelves. Because if you're not concerned about this food supply problem, you better be. We have a huge supply and demand of food across this nation. We can feed the world ourselves, and yet we're destroying our harvests. At the same time, we are importing beef from other countries, beef that is less regulated than our beef, less safe, not as high quality of product, and yet it's happening. At the same time, they are preparing for us to euthanize our harvests. That doesn't sound like sustainability to me, but it is part of the overall goal to vertically integrate your food system. You see, they cannot have control of the people unless they have control of the food, the water, the land, production. It is time we get back to work. We are of, by, and for the people. This is not Nancy Pelosi's country. This is not Donald Trump's country. This is your country, and you're going to go hungry.
And while American farmers are destroying their harvests, U.S. beef is exported to China. U.S. meat plants are closing at a rapid rate, including Cargill Meat, who supplies 22% of the U.S. meat market, and who partnered with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2018 to end livestock production while expanding the production of genetically modified soy in Africa. Reporting for Infowars.com, this is Greg Reese.
Well, you can do something about that. In part, our sponsor, Infowarsstore.com, provides storable food so that you are prepared and that you are prepped for this circumstance and situation. So go to Infowarsstore.com, get the storable food so that you will not be isolated and left in a position where you are unprotected. There's also a wide range of other products you can get. They are the ones that make this platform possible. They are the ones that continue to provide independent information in this age of state censorship and big tech censorship as big tech substitutes in for Orwell's Big Brother. Let's look at some of the other economic news and information that's out there. Let's look at chart number 4. What you see here is the U.S. consumption chart. And what you'll see is activities over all the way back to the 1950s. And it has mostly stayed within a certain range. And when you look at the chart, all of a sudden you get to now, and it has dropped off of a cliff. It is at a rate that is unparalleled and unprecedented in modern American global history. So you see it has all within that, and if you go to the end of the chart, you'll find it just goes all the way down. That's where the line goes. Let's look at chart number 17 and look at some other disturbing information in terms of what's happening in the economy. Chart number 17 shows you two things. That blue line is the rate of debt to GDP, and it's the highest rate it's been in forever. It is over close to 2.5 now. That's the blue line that's going up, 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 up. That's what our debt ratio is, now more than double GDP, gross domestic product. That red line is velocity. That's the velocity of the money supply. That tells you how much economic activity is taking place, and it is plummeting. So all of the money they've been funneling into the economy, most of it's just been going to the stock market to bail out the stock market. And we'll go to that next, the chart number 18. And what you'll see there is that you'll see the Fed is spending money like crazy. Look at that. That chart, that line just spikes up. That's the balance sheet of the Fed, the highest it has ever been in the history of the Fed. You're talking about a 50% increase in 6 weeks of their balance sheet, and it's only going to keep going and keep growing. And so despite all of that money that they're pouring into the markets to prop up the stock markets, to prop up the corporate bond markets, to prop up the municipal bond markets, to prop up our U.S. treasuries, it's not translating into real economy. It's not translating into ordinary spending. It's not translating into better jobs and secure opportunities for America's future. By contrast, that's why we've had people like the guest we'll have tonight, George Gammon. And let's play a clip from video clip number one, where over a month ago, he was talking to someone about the utility of buying oil tanker stocks. He turned out to be very prescient. If you had done so, you would be in a much better financial position today. It was one of the many predictions he got right, from property taxes to food prices. So let's take a look at clip video number one.
What on earth is happening? So what I'd like to do next is, I'm sure every viewer and listener right now saying, okay, George has this amazing fund manager that talks to all these super smart guys on a daily basis. And he's just an extremely intelligent guy. He's been doing this. He's been running his own money and other people's money for a long, long time. So what are you looking at in the world as far as opportunities to actually make money?
So, like I said, in the short term, it's a matter of understanding that liquidity is the only thing that matters. And in that environment, it's dollars. So we're long dollars. There's other little trades around it. We're long tankers.
That's a very interesting play there. Like, so number one, could you explain that a little bit further, like why you're bullish and why you see that as an opportunity, and then how someone might play that? You know, can you explain that? Because I think that was really unique.
Sure. Firstly, we had massive demand destruction in the energy markets, in oil, as a consequence of the virus. That allowed, and look, shale was going to go away anyway, but that just put them in a much more difficult situation. They had a wall of debt that's coming 2022. If you look at their bonds, we've been talking about this for ages, saying these guys, it's a disaster. Shale's never, as an industry, actually produced a profit. And then it comes back to the whole, you know, hey, the US believes that they're self-sufficient in energy. Yes, sort of, but at a loss. Which is then to say that they're not really self-sufficient in the global economy. Nevertheless, they believe they are. That's also created a whole lot of different geopolitical happenings. But back to the oil thing, shale was always going to have issues. It was continuously having issues. Then this oil thing hit. And what happened was the Russians, who've de-dollarized their economy, built up massive reserves in gold, who now basically don't really give a shit about the ruble, because they can take that cushion, take the ruble cushion and let their currency decline and just keep pumping oil. They looked at it. That's why they basically broke up OPEC Plus and said, the hell with this. We're just going to pump. Now, there's other reasons, I guess, we could argue why they didn't want to cut supply, and that was also because Russian oil is not quite the same as, say, Saudi oil. You can't just shut down their production. Half of the stuff is in inhospitable environments whereby if they shut it down, it basically ices over, and it can take them up to 18 months to get it back up into production. So they can't just turn it on and turn it off. It's very costly. So they have to keep it going anyway. So that's another sort of side thing with the oil market. But basically they looked at this and said, okay, we've got this opportunity in front of us, and we're going to really gain market share, and we're going to take these shale players out of the business. Because they've been, you know, the big kid on the block over the last decade. They have, been the swing player. And so the Russians, and that was never good for Russia. So they've seen this opportunity and said, okay, we can do this now. We've de-dollarized our economy. We've got strong balance sheet. We're just going to give it to them now. They're on the ground. They're on their knees. Let's kick them in the guts. And so they went and they've just increased production. The Saudis, who wanted to cut, basically had an option. They were like, okay, we either cut and it's not really that meaningful, or we do the same thing and we help, we together with the Russians gain extra market share, or at least remain retain the market share that they've got. And so the world's now in this weird situation where we've got demands going off a cliff and supply is just going through the roof.
Right.
And then, of course, Donald Trump turned around and said, "What the hell with you guys? We're going to just keep up production. I'm going to support the shale industry." So it's a bit like three kids and the bullies in the playground all fighting with each other. And and they're all like, it doesn't, none of it makes economic sense. But what right. it means is that it's anywhere from a billion to 2 billion barrels of oil that's going to come onto the market over the next 6 months. Into a market that doesn't have anywhere near the demand that it had before. Everybody's sitting at home watching Netflix. No one's using gasoline. And so then the question is, where does all that oil go? Mm. Most of the above ground reserves are already taken up. Trump said he's going to fill the strategic reserve. I think it's 74 or 77, million barrels. That's going to be filled like within a couple of months. Then where does it go? Stick it on a tanker. That's what you do. So all the big
you literally store the physical oil on a tanker out just floating around.
Sure. Sure. Yep. Sure. And so the big boys like the Glencores and all the big oil traders, they'll be doing that now. And they can make a ton of money out of it because they can buy future delivery, or they can sell future delivery into the market now and buy spot, which is lower because it's in contango. And pocket right. the difference. It's a completely risk-free trade for them. The only cost to doing that trade is storing the bloody oil for 6, 12 months, 24 months, but depending on what future they sell it at. So they're going to do that, and they're going to do that all day long because it's just free money. You're literally booking the trade. You're going, okay, sold to you on the
spot price.
Let's just say it's 12 months out. Bought at spot here. What's the difference? At the moment, we're running about $11, or you know, and so you can do that on freaking what's I think you get.
So the people understand. So the futures price of oil is about $10 to $11 higher than the spot price of oil. So if you can buy right now at spot and then immediately sell a future that's delivered, let's say in a year. And then it costs you only $5 to store it over the year,
yeah.
and you just
yeah.
pocket the arbitrage free money.
Yeah, I mean it depends on the duration. There's different durations and different prices, but the point is that structural market exists.
Okay.
And then the cost is just storing it. So you just lease a tanker, stick it on the tanker, and walk away, trade done. But a lot of that capital, most of
so exactly.
goes to the tanker.
Well, what was discussed there was they predicted and forecast, George Gammon's guess, that how oil tankers were going to be able to make money. And in fact, that's precisely what happened about a week or two ago. That video was shot way back. And in fact, the consequence of it is if you'd made that investment, you would have made good cash. So we're going to have up next George Gammon, the man who interviewed the guest who helped make that prediction, along with other prescient predictions about the future of a post-pandemic economy. So join us right after the break. Welcome back to American Countdown. Our next guest is George Gammon. You can find him on YouTube. You can find him in the Rebel Capitalist podcast. You can find him on Twitter at George Gammon. He provides fantastic information. I'll just give you three little pieces of information he's provided with he and his guests that he interviews across the independent economic analyst spectrum, aside from your CNBC regulars. One was what you just saw, the prediction about oil tankers, which I think was about a month, 5 weeks ago. That show, and I actually gave that tip out to a few other people who took it and cashed in, that ended up becoming very true as spot oil actually dropped negative for a period of time in the last several weeks. Another one was that property taxes might be on the rise sooner rather than later due to the issue of the problems of states spending money they don't have, cities and counties spending money they don't have. While the Fed has tried to bail out the municipal bond market with various alphabet agencies that they've created and off-the-book special vehicle units, as they call them, to try to get around the legal limits the Fed is supposed to be operating under. In fact, there was announcements from various governments this week that property taxes are going to be going up. In the same vein, he talked about the risk of food basket prices going up, food supply issues creating supply-demand issues. We already saw that happening in various parts of the country just this week in a wide range of reports. So we're pleased to have George back with us on the show to discuss what the post-pandemic economy might look like, how frightening it might be, and how you might still survive and be prepared for it. Glad you can be with us, George.
Robert, it's great to be here. I need a cigar, buddy, like you.
Yes,
I got to send me down some of those cigars.
Exactly. Well, luckily there's not yet a cigar shortage, though a lot of the cigar shops have been closed down the last couple of weeks.
Right.
And there's been some import issues from a particular location that has been problematic, unfortunately. But hopefully they'll cure at least that issue amongst the wild range of economic issues we're seeing in really almost unprecedented, unparalleled territory. We're going in with a whole bunch of central banks experimenting based on what you identified recently as sort of a recency bias, believing that what they did in 08, 09 magically could continue in any context or any circumstance. And we're already seeing that that is not necessarily translating. As the Fed's balance sheet goes way up, velocity of money is going down, more reports of people hoarding cash. So there's whether or not even when they lift the shutdowns, which who knows when that will happen in large parts of the Western world, it's not clear that that new world will look anything like the old one.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing you have to look at is the supply side of the equation, because everyone gets the demand side. Just like you said, we go into lockdown, everyone's staying in their house, very few people are out driving around or just spending money. So we get that, but most people don't look at the supply side. So I did an example in one of my videos of just a typical McDonald's, and I looked at their profit and loss. And you see they've got about a 5.7% profit margin at the end of the day, but most of their costs are fixed from a standpoint of their employees. So just long story short, it makes it very difficult for them to lower their prices. Typically, they just have to go out of business. So if they go out of business, you have a reduction in the supply. At some point in time, although the demand might shrink substantially, you have the supply go down so low that it still increases prices. Another example that I used is airlines, and this is just totally anecdotal, but a very good friend of mine, Jason Hartman at jasonhartman.com, great real estate expert, but he's a very good macro thinker as well. He sent me just a flight that he looked up just going from Miami to Los Angeles, and he went back about 90 days prior to the coronavirus, and what you saw was the flight was right around, let's say, $350. And once we started seeing this collapse in the stock market and everything was just imploding back in the middle of March, you saw prices for this flight just drop all the way down to like $100 a round trip. I mean, it's crazy. But then what you've seen more recently in the last couple of weeks is prices of the exact same flight go up, and they're now more expensive than they were prior to the coronavirus. But the catch is there's a lot fewer flights. So I think people need to really look at the supply side of the equation, like I was saying earlier, and understand that we could see prices increase while at the same time the unemployment rate is going up substantially, very similar to what happened in the 1970s.
It's very much. It's what's fascinating is we're in unprecedented territory, and that we could have inflation in some assets, deflation. Well, I should say inflation in the ways it impacts ordinary people and what they buy every day, the basket of goods that the CPI is mostly based on, while we see deflation in certain assets. May see unemployment continue to rise to the stagflation you're talking about, while the dollar stays strong in foreign markets that they can't even figure out a way to get it down because of a wide range of dollar-denominated debt around the world. And to give you to your airline example, I have a lot of people who travel all across the country for my work. And right when the collapse hit, they could get I made the mistake of not buying them. They could buy air tickets in advance for $29 coast to coast. That's how cheap some of the airline tickets were. Now, because they're just canceling flights routinely, like Southwest will put you on there and then cancel two-thirds of the flights the next day. I was supposed to be in Tennessee last weekend for a protest gathering. My flight got canceled the morning of. And the average prices, Southwest and others, is skyrocketing. In fact, they're higher now than they have typically been for almost any place in the country that people want to get to. And it is because of what you're talking about, dramatically shrinking supply. And there was talk today, American Airlines is just going to disband a bunch of its planes early. It's going to put them out to retirement, put them out to pasture. And that same dynamic has taken place. And what's interesting to me is the biggest discussion of what should be happening economically is mostly not happening in the public discourse. Outside of your channel and independent channels, most ordinary people, when I talk about, hey, by the way, the Fed is, did you know the Fed's balance sheet is up a couple of $1 trillion? They think that's the stimulus bill. They don't know that it's something separate, something distinct, something different, and that the Fed's balance sheet is just going through the roof. And what's most disturbing is if this was supposed to work, if this modern monetary theory and helicopter money was supposed to inspire spending, it's not happening yet. And I assume that there's a risk it just doesn't come back at all. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, the first thing people need to understand when you look at the Fed's balance sheet is they assume that it's going up as a result almost exclusively of the Fed buying U.S. assets. But what they're not understanding is a lot of that rise has to do with dollar swap lines. So what are those? That's when the Fed is bailing out other countries. That's the short answer. So how it works is the Fed will set up a swap line with another central bank. Let's call it the Bank of England. So the Bank of England needs dollars because so many entities in the UK have dollar denominated debt. It's very hard to find these dollars to service the debt. So it creates all these problems. So the Fed steps in and says, listen, you guys can send us your currency. We'll give you the dollars and then we can swap back at a later date. So now the question is, okay, if they swap back, let's say in 90 days, how do we know the Fed isn't just going to roll it over and allow them to continue to keep the dollars, just like they have with the repo market? And so I think if Americans knew, well, first and foremost, to your point, they don't really understand what's going on with the Fed's balance sheet. But even if they did understand what's going on with the balance sheet, if they took it a step further, I think they'd really start to question the motives of the Fed. And also, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I want to go back to your earlier point about property taxes increasing. It has to do with these dollar swap lines. And I did an interview today with Marin Katusa, and he pointed out some very interesting information that these dollar swap lines could be weaponized because these other countries need the dollars so badly. The United States can and has set up swap lines with just specific countries. So if they leave you out in the cold, then it's almost like putting sanctions on a specific economy that they might not like. So the retaliation, what he's seen, is some of these countries have suggested that they might take over U.S. company assets in their jurisdiction, such as gold mines or such as maybe an oil reserve. And the reason I'm saying that is because it shows us that when times get tough, governments, whether it's the United States or any other government around the world, will find whoever has the resources or the cash, and they'll come after that entity, whether it's an individual, a corporation, it just doesn't matter. And it goes back to the property taxes. The worse it gets here in the United States, and I think we're at a very minimum going into a recession, it might be a depression, we'll see. But as American citizen, don't think that the government isn't going to come after you as well if you're one of those people that has resources. So how do they do that? First and foremost, they're going to jack property taxes. That's why it was so obvious to me back, whatever, a month or two ago, that this would most likely be the outcome, because those are the people with the assets. So the government will go after them. They'll try to pick your pocket any way they can. And I think that we'll get higher taxes across the board. It won't just be in property taxes. But then you take it a step further, and they admit that they're trying to create inflation. So what is inflation? It's just another indirect tax that steals the purchasing power of savers. So I guess my point is that expect this in the future. And unfortunately, the worse things get, the more you're going to see the governments being intrusive and trying to take your purchasing power, whether it's directly through taxes or indirectly through inflation.
Precisely. I think one of the backdrops that briefly sort of popped up in the public debate, but only the sort of the tip of the iceberg of the issues, is everything related to municipal bonds of governments and state government debts. You combine that with state pensions, which have been badly underfunded and in a huge problem, and part of the sort of almost political quid pro quo that's been happening with, hey, corporation, we'll give you some tax cuts so that you will go in and buy back your debt, basically do buybacks of your stock, do corporate debt, yeah, and use that money to buy back your stock. And in turn, that will help boost the bond so it won't be a junk bond, so that the pension funds can be invested in a wide range of ways, so they can at least get close to that 7-8% they're supposed to be doing when they're already badly, terribly underfunded. Well, you combine that, you compound the state debt problem that already existed. You combine that with the state pension fund problem that's off the charts. And then they've been shutting down their economies in a lot of these Democratic states, California, Illinois, New York. And that's why they're screaming, we better get a huge, massive federal government bailout, not just the Fed doing what they're doing and buying up, propping up the muni bond market, but also we want massive cash, because otherwise they're always going to be in this trouble. But they're using COVID-19 as the pretext to get a bailout. It's almost like they're deliberately extending the shutdown in the hopes, yeah, that they can use that as the thing to blame to get that in. Could you explain to people what that constellation of issues and how that ultimately shows up in things like state property taxes and probably on the federal level, a recommended wealth tax?
Well, just to simplify it as much as I can, you'll say you've got a pension fund and their liabilities are what they promise to the people who have been putting in all these years, the workers, is a 7% return on their money. So that's their target. That's what they have to achieve. What happens, the Federal Reserve comes in and drops interest rates to 0% for, call it 8 years, but we've gone back and forth, a very artificially low interest rate environment. Well, if you're a pension fund that has to put all this money to work and you have to get a 7% return, how do you do that in an environment with 0% interest rates? It becomes very, very difficult. The only way to achieve your objective is to go further out the risk curve. All that means is you just take more risk than you otherwise would. So if you're that pension fund and you can get, let's say, a 6% return on a 10-year treasury, which you normally would, well, then you're golden. You've got nothing to worry about. But if you can't, then how do you get the 7% return? Well, a few ways. Well, you can go into corporate debt, which you talked about earlier. You could get as you go into BBB debt, which is right on the cusp. You could go into private equity. You could purchase equities outright, and things that are politically correct to buy. And what I'm talking about there is, like, you've got the pension fund in California and they buy Tesla or Uber, something like that. Well, why are they buying that? Well, let's be honest, because it makes them look good. It's kind of it's the political thing to do, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a good investment for their the people that they owe the money to. But they also lever up. I want to make sure people are clear there. So they'll not only go into the corporate bond market, which in and of itself is more risky than a treasury, they'll do it at, let's say, 50% leverage. So if they're getting that 3.5% return, well, then they say, well, we got to have 7. So they take out a bunch of leverage and go into the market. And so you just compound the risk. And it gets to a situation where they're already way underfunded. And the more problems they have, the more risk they'll take. Well, the more risk they take, if we get a down market or a recession, the more in the hole they're going to be. Then the only release valve for them to fill that gap in their pension is to come after the taxpayer. Again, they've got to. It's got to come from somewhere. So that's kind of the last resort. And that's where you see it play out in increasing property taxes. But I think they'll increase sales tax, property taxes, you name it. And it's going up. I mean, if you're someone that is a producer, you have a mid-sized business, you're an entrepreneur in a state like New York, New Jersey, Illinois, I mean, they're going to be coming after you. I can promise you, I would get out of there as fast as I could.
Exactly. No doubt about it. Cause I see it as twofold. That tax power is often about control and power. So that I do a lot of tax law representation. It's sort of what I made my bones in before I went into a broad area of law, civil and constitutional law. But the, even though it was constitutional issues that got me into tax law because they were targeting people for their political beliefs, people like Irwin Schiff, people like Wesley yeah. Snipes, a range of people who were mostly being targeted. And I started to understand it more because the government was paranoid of tax dissent more than almost anything in the legal political spectrum, because they understood America was founded when a few people got together and decided those taxes weren't fair or equitable or little democratic. And that almost every revolution in the history of the world is tied to people who just decide not to pay taxes. That's why Noam Chomsky decided that was the most effective means to resist Vietnam. He decided was actually if 20-25% of the people did not pay their income tax in protest. And they immediately shut that down by prosecuting a range of people, of course. But the, they're scared and terrified of it because it's so key to their control, so key to their power. Because tax control, all the tax loopholes allow you to favor certain and say, hey, you, if you do this, this, and this, we'll give you special rewards. If you don't, we're going to punish you over here. That's what a lot of the tax laws are written to do, is to basically, it's a policy prescription disguised as a tax law. And in that same context, given the underlying problems our local governments have, that they've kept a good lid on for the most part. Trump talked about it a little bit today and yesterday, said, why should we be bailing out states that have had 25 years of problems? But he's going to, they've created the pandemic has been a perfect pretext. I remember you had somebody on your show was talking about anybody smart that was in the market that had problems on their books should be going in and fixing those little book problems and just attributing it to the pandemic as yeah. quickly and as easily as they can. But in this context, yeah. you get to like a wealth tax. And it's a wonderful title. I give them credit. It's a much better. It's like the estate tax. It sounds much better than saying we want to tax dead people. The wealth tax is effectively a property tax that legally, constitutionally is not supposed to happen in the United States at a federal level. But there's more and more and more talk of it. And I see it just as I see UBI coming into guise of, you know, momentary, temporary help, transitory help. We're seeing the same thing happen on the other side in terms of more talk of the wealth tax and the issues that it could impose, and almost creating like a caste-like system between essential and non-essential people. Just the label sounds like something out of 19th century India. And you had a good YouTube this week, a good video this week about what happens when you're getting better benefits from unemployment than you yeah. could if you go back into the labor market. I'm hearing from small employers that that's a problem. So we already have a spending problem. What happens if we compound it with people who don't even want to go back into employment because the government's told them they'll give them more money if they stay at home?
Yeah, it goes back to inflation. I mean, that's going to destroy supply because those, what you do is you set up this perverse environment where employers are competing with the government for their employees, like who will pay them the most. So if the government is willing to pay them, let's say 50% more than the employer, well, the employer can't pay that much because typically they're going to pay the employee what they can produce. If your employee can produce, let's say $100,000 a year, that you can't pay them 200. That math doesn't work. If the government's paying them 200, you can't compete. If you don't have any of your employees, you go out of business. And let's take it a step further. So that, yes, that is inflationary. At a certain point, maybe short term, it could be deflationary because you have so many entities go out of business. But over the long run, you have fewer goods and services that are created right here in the United States. Well, people are still going to want to consume. They still want to see stuff on the shelves at Walmart or Target. So what ends up happening is you start importing more from foreign countries. So we're importing more of their goods and services so we don't have to create them ourselves. And the only thing we have to do is export these little green pieces of paper. It's great. You know, you can just sit back on your couch and have everything made for you And all you have to do is click a couple buttons on your computer screen, print up $1 trillion. It goes over to China or India or Japan or wherever. And then they ship you all of these goods and services. The problem is, what do the foreigners do with the dollars? They come right back and they buy U.S. denominated assets or USD assets. So let's look at treasuries as an example, or real estate or bonds or corporate bonds or equities, anything that's denominated in dollars. They want to find productive assets to put the dollars they're making to work. So you have this situation where we produce less and less stuff in the United States, while at the same time, we're selling more and more and more of our assets to foreigners. So you get to a point theoretically where we don't create any of our own stuff. Foreigners own all of our assets. So they control everything. They control the amount we consume, because to consume, you first have to produce, right? So if all of our producing is being done overseas, they control our level of consumption and they control all the assets in our country. And going back to that video you referenced, I at the end of the video, I read the definition of slavery. And I didn't come to any conclusion, but if you look at the proper definition of slavery and where we would be as a society in the United States, it's very darn close, I can tell you that. And going back to your original point, the more we subsidize people and incentivize people to stay at home, the closer we're coming to that end result.
Exactly. I mean, I always think of it as that scene from The Matrix where you see all the human beings caught up in the machines and they're creating a virtual reality to distract them. But mostly they're just treated as consuming machines, if you will, just sort of in the system and have no real power or control themselves. Because what's terrifying is that they're starting to come into place something you could call a coherent plan. But it's not necessarily one that looks good for ordinary people. You're seeing Wall Street favored over Main Street. You did a good video on that as well. You're seeing the Fed bail out the stock market, but not bail out the small businessmen. You're seeing them discourage employees, and then you have shutdown orders that effectively prohibit small businesses from even acting. A lot of small businesses only had 30 days of reserves. A lot of them are already done and dead. We're going to see that, I think, when the economy reopens in some states. I already know places, been around 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, gone, done, finito, simply because of what happened here. And it's almost like what they're creating is an American consumer class who's completely dependent upon the government for their only source of means, and increasingly will be dependent upon foreign governments and nations for the actual production of their goods and the purchases of their debts. And I thought one of the other things you pointed out good was, at some point, if we won't be able to inflate our way out of the debt without running the risk that all of a sudden nobody wants to buy that debt anymore, in particularly foreign nations. And it was interesting to me today when I saw India talk about they're going to issue a special bond that's going to be gold-backed just to get people to buy their bonds. What's your thoughts about that side of the equation?
Well, again, people have recency bias, and I think the recency bias is that we'll never see inflation again because we haven't seen it for a lot, or people think that we haven't seen it. If you look at just the government statistics with the CPI, and
we'll be right back with George right after the break. Sorry about that, George. We'll be right back.
British are coming. The British are coming. You are about to be marched on face to face. And one moral plan.
America first. Ask not what your country wants.
Welcome back to American Countdown. We'll be taking your calls in the bottom half of the hour. You can call 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. Or 512, if you're calling internationally, where George is located safely, securely outside of aspects of the United States currently, which may be wise and sage. 512-646-1776. That's 512-646-1776. As we look at this sort of matrix-type economy, the concern I have is that when you combine the Fed buying up U.S. corporate equities, talking today they're going to start buying up U.S. corporate equities with the treasury of U.S. oil companies, that's basically sounds a lot like nationalization of oil companies effectively. They're just calling it by the different label. buying up other equities, buying up state and municipal government bonds and debt, which means they could be the principal or primary creditor, which you don't have to watch a show like Billions or others to figure out what that can look like of a local government, how coercive it can be. People can go back and look what happened to San Diego County back in the 90s and early 2000s. That basically what happens is the Fed could be the voting shareholder, if they wanted it effectively, through their special vehicle units of large U.S. corporations, governments across the country, within the United States. They're also controlling what happens with the money supply to a certain degree based on what they're doing and our relationships to foreign governments. And at the same time, increasing taxing power by state and local governments to satisfy some of these credit obligations and other duties. And at the same time, encouraging people to stay at home or ordering they stay at home for the time being, but incentivizing it and creating a lifestyle to see how accustomed they get to it, with these, basically uniform basic income. And already Nancy Pelosi is talking about extending the $1,200 a month to make it permanent, on top of unemployment insurance being expanded so that it's higher than a lot of your businesses can actually meaningfully compete with, while the Main Street is being wiped out. You combine it and you start to get a combined story of this being a massive power grab by the Fed and the government over people's ordinary everyday lives, to where people are economically dependent on them, have very little economic independence from them. It's like the running story I've said is that we would always take 77 years of American freedom over 78 years of Cuban style social control. And I've argued that as to relates to the pandemic, most Americans would choose 1 year less on their life expectancy if it meant 77 years of American freedom. But it looks like we're increasingly taking some of the Cuban social control techniques and starting to apply aspects of it economically. I mean, what Castro did very early on when he ran into economic trouble was ultimately shut down the small businesses. It took him about 6-7 years to do it. But then after that, he's nationalized most of the U.S. Domestic industry that was located there within Cuba. And the government, ended up, of course, ultimately running everything. That it seems like we are on a correlated path to that potential outcome, which could even be more compounded if we end up developing a government-based digital currency and the kind of controls that it could impose, using as a pretext the problems we're currently experiencing with the dollar in this bifurcated world of inflation potentially domestically and a too strong dollar internationally. What's your thoughts about how much of a risk are we facing unless there's more political and social resistance to that, of that kind of dystopia becoming our matrix-driven economy in the future?
I think we're definitely headed for a digital currency. That's for sure. Just to focus on that part of your statement, because it gives the government just too much power. And I'm not a big fan of politicians, as you probably know. And I don't think they're the smartest tools in the shed. But once they start to understand the type of control it will give them, I just can't understand how they're going to ignore it. And you also see the Treasury, and you see a lot of the public sector, a lot of the federal government are hiring individuals that were in the private sector that worked at a lot of these crypto companies such as Coinbase. And obviously, the writing's on the wall. And I don't think the typical American really understands how much control this gives the government. They just see it as kind of an electronic dollar, and they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, I mean, is that really a big deal, Robert? I mean, all the dollars right now are electronic. I can't even tell you the last time I used cash. I just use my debit card and it electronically goes to the business. And we pretty much already have an electronic dollar, or a digital currency, if you will. What they don't understand is that this is a completely different system, in the sense that the Treasury, or maybe the Federal Reserve, would have a ledger system. And every single currency unit that they create electronically that would go to the American public in the form of, let's say, UBI, and it would go right to their cell phone. They just download we'll call it the Fed app, and the Fed would just transfer that money directly to them once a month, $1,000, $2,000, whatever. But each one of these currency units has a tracking number. So it can be programmed. Each one of these, they're not electronic dollars, they're pieces of software. So if the Fed wants to, they could say, okay, no more spending on gas-powered cars. just using this as an example. And so what would happen is all the, we'll call them the Fed coins that are now on your Fed app that you receive from the government, and everyone will gladly do it because who doesn't want this free money? Who doesn't want free purchasing power? But then what happens is they put all these stipulations that if you try to run your and spend your Fed coins at the local car dealership for a gas-powered car, it just doesn't work. And so that's an example of how they would control the demand side. They'd also control the supply side from the sense that if they didn't want a producer or if they didn't like a specific company, all they would do is just turn them off and they wouldn't have access to any more of these Fed coins. And they're basically out of business. Also, if they didn't like you for whatever reason, and let's just say that they were worried about taxpayers leaving the United States because they just didn't like what was going on. They didn't like the environment. They didn't like the lack of freedom. And to your earlier point, if we see anything in the future because of this virus, like we saw in 9/11, you're going to have, I even hate to think of the restrictions on our freedoms moving forward. But let's just say you're a person that doesn't want any part of that. Well, if there's no cash, they could just say, okay, Robert, you know what? We don't want you leaving the country. You pay a lot of money in taxes and we want you keeping that money right here. So you're free to leave. Go right ahead, but you just can't take your money. And they have that type of control with they have no currency or they ban cash and they go to this digital currency. I could literally go on for the next 2 hours on how bad a digital currency is for individuals who value their personal liberties. But it's something that unfortunately I think we've got to look for, and it's not a matter of when, or excuse me, it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Exactly. And what do you think could be the effective means, if any, of sort of countering that? Like, I've heard people talk about Bitcoin as a potential, having actual physical possession of gold, which is, it's interesting. What you were talking about earlier, I saw a headline today of somebody talking about a government talking about seizing a gold mine somewhere. So that risk is sort of there constantly with governments around the world because of where gold is physically produced and also where it's stored. What do you think can be the counter to that for people attempting to not end up become part of that matrix kind of economy?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I'd take it a step further. So just to reiterate, Bitcoin, I think, is very interesting. I think that gold and silver is kind of the default position. I actually like gold jewelry as well, because if you look throughout history, although a lot of countries have confiscated gold, based on my research, I haven't found a country that's actually confiscated jewelry. So that might be an interesting approach where, let's say, you have $100,000 necklace and you don't like what's going on in the United States. They've banned cash. They have the Fed coin on the Fed app that they won't let you take. Well, you just put that necklace around your neck and you hop on the next flight. You might look like Mr. T for a while, but at least it allows you to take some purchasing power outside of the country. But I think what Americans can do right now before this happens, take some sort of, try to get ahead of the curve. What I always tell my viewers is make sure that you diversify your portfolio. We all know what that means, but also diversify your political risk and diversify your currency risk. So why not have a bank account overseas or in a country you like? Maybe you enjoy spending time in, we'll call it Switzerland, or you enjoy spending time in Croatia, Montenegro. These are all places that I quite like. But, why not set up a bank account the next time you're there? And you don't have to have a lot of money in there, but just set it up. So if need be, you always kind of have it as a plan B. And then if you want to take it a step further, maybe you start to apply for residency or a visa in a country like Colombia. I've got some investments here, so I don't really live in Colombia. I travel all over, but because of my investments, I was able to apply for a visa, which after 5 years gives me the right to have a passport. So I have another passport in addition to the U.S. passport. But I've got a lot of assets all over the world and denominated in different currencies. And although many people probably aren't my position. I think they could start doing it at a small scale to just have a plan B. And I mean, what's your downside to that?
Exactly. I always call it jurisdictional diversification, that you don't want to be dependent on one particular banking system, one particular government, one particular central bank, because you never know what's going to happen. I always describe it as, you know, if you were Jewish in Germany in 1930, you didn't know what was coming. But if you had prepared and planned, you wouldn't have to wait for Schindler's List to get out of Dodge. If you had the means and mechanism to do so, having things that are transportable, physical wealth, watches, diamonds, jewelry, all good and useful, because you can carry a lot of money on your physical body in that way, having multiple forms of currency, having more residencies and citizenships to the degree you can afford that. There are ways to get it in an accessible, affordable way that's becoming more manageable. But at a minimum, I always like the movie Heat, where he says, never have anything in your life that you can't walk out on in 15 seconds flat if you feel the heat around the corner. I always describe that as always be prepared so that you have like a Bourne Identity suitcase and you can walk out the door in 15 seconds flat and be wherever else you need to be if something goes wrong with your local governmental system, banking system, or financial system. To sink all of your eggs into one state, into one government, is ill-advised just when you look at the history of governments and you look at human history. And we're seeing that highlighted and accelerated now. So I think that's a fantastic, good recommendation. So thanks, George, for being with us, taking your time out. You can find him on YouTube. You can find him on the Rebel Capitalist podcast. You can find him on Twitter. He has videos up all the time. They're educational. They're affordable. They're affordable because they're free, but they're also accessible. And it's an unusual combination of accessibility and actionability and taking what can otherwise be very complex ideas and making them accessible to everybody. So you don't have to have a degree in economics to understand the presentation, understand what to look for, understand how to be prepared as we go through these extraordinary times. So thanks for being with us, George.
Thanks for having me, Robert. Can't wait to do it again.
Absolutely. No doubt we live in unique times, and unique times in both a pandemic economy and post-pandemic economy that are highlighting extraordinary risk both to our civil liberties and to our ability to support and survive independent of government and state control. That is the highlighted risk. That's what the coordinated components of this are. The economic policy may look like it's just about economics. It may look like it's just about politics, but in the end, it's about power. In the end, it's about state control. That's why they're doing things like, let's see if we can keep people at home whenever we tell them. Let's see if we can get them dependent upon us as the sole source of their economic material well-being. Let's see if we can shift resources to favored politically connected groups on Wall Street and completely dismantle Main Street as may be useful. Ask yourself, why is the small retail store closed while the Walmarts and the big stores are open? Why is Costco open, but your local small hardware store not allowed to open? Why is it that some of these big retailers are open, but not your small local mom and pop shops? Look at who they're using this pandemic as a pretext to wipe out economically, wipe out their political power ultimately, shift economic power from one group to another, also shifts political power from one group to another. So they're using this experiment, this real live Milgram experiment. The Milgram experiment was back in the 1950s where they did studies and they got people to walk in and they had someone on the other side and said, just shock them if they don't answer correctly. And the only reason to shock them, to electrically shock them, was because someone in a white lab coat told them to do it. And what was disturbing was how many people just kept shocking the other person, even when they heard screams of pain next door for something that was disproportionate in terms of, you know, you got an answer wrong and so you're supposed to dial it up by 450 knots. But that is what, in fact, people did. Well, we're living in a real live Milgram experiment where people in the white lab coats are directing us what to do. And the politicians and the banks and the central banks and the politically connected economic folks are using it as an opportunity to change the ledger of assets and liabilities amongst the entire American public economy, and doing so and putting things into motion, as what George talks about, leading to the ultimate form of control. First form of control is you own the local government's debt, you own the debt, you own the government. Step two, you own people by having them dependent upon you for their resources rather than having other small enterprises in the private marketplace and the free market system that they can find productive work with. The next step, though, is to ultimately use the currency problems created by our current low interest, arbitrary low interest economic structure that the Fed has put in post 2008 as a pretext to impose a digital currency that then can control everything you do, because the government can decide what you can spend, where you can spend it, when you can spend it, whether you can save it, or whether it gets wiped out overnight. It is the ultimate form of governmental control. Add to that, people like Bill Gates are not only developing ways to make digital vaccines and put little quantum tattoos on you to measure you and to trace you and to track you, but he's also looking at developing patents for cryptocurrencies that could also be digital. Well, maybe the government will end up doing that instead, so that not only do you have a little chip in your arm in order to be able to do anything productive in physical society because it's a digital vaccine or tracking whether or not you have received the vaccine, but also maybe a little chip in your arm, a little chip in your hand in order to make sure that's the only means by which you can either get anything you need or receive anything you need in terms of a cryptocurrency or a digital currency that is in fact a governmental control mechanism and method. These are all risks that we face if we are not observant and we are not diligent and we don't take the steps to prepare for ourselves and also the political activism necessary to try to prevent that world from coming to bear. In that regard, there are ways you can prepare by getting things that are healthy for you and good for you by providing support for our sponsor, InfoWarsStore.com, where you can get things like storable food, where you can get things like supplements that provide for your health, where you can be prepared where other people are not prepared. You can be ready where other people are not ready. That is part of what this show has been about. That is part of what the InfoWars platform has been about, is providing independent information so you can make your own decisions, so that you can have full education and public participation and make sure that you are taking the steps economically to defend and protect yourself. So in the bottom half of the hour, we'll be taking your calls from you, the jury, for what you have inquiries about. And you can call at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. Or if you're calling internationally, you can call at 512-646-1776. In other contexts, where in the way that the Fed is sort of flinning all of us, we have reminders of what happened to General Flynn today as a wide range of people came to the defense of the FBI within the institutional press and within some of the corporate legal class and ex-prosecutors and ex-agents, which is really disturbing and unsettling given what they did. Because what they did was every form of violation you could possibly conceive and imagine. What they did was they created a case that didn't exist. More information came out today that in fact, when they had looked, they had done a microscopic review of everything related to Michael Flynn, and independent agents came back and reported, they called it Operation Razor, came back and determined that, in fact, there was nothing. There was no evidence of any wrongdoing by General Flynn at all in anything and everything they looked at, and they have the most investigative and invasive powers in the world, the federal law enforcement authorities in the United States. And despite that, people at the political high ranks on the seventh floor of the FBI intervened, prevented the case from being closed, reopened it as a bogus Logan Act case. The Logan Act has no criminal application in a meaningful way. It's never been applied or enforced in the United States' history. It is constitutionally questionable and dubious in its scope and its application. And so it was simply a pretext to continue a case that they recognized had no credibility, had no basis to continue. Despite that, they then went about creating a pretext to do an entrapment interview where they said they were coming over solely to talk to him about other things. And instead, they were actually there to try to get him to say something that they could later call a lie, even though their internal documents showed that they knew he did not lie at the time or did not believe he was lying at the time. They had denied him access to the information and basically did a memory test and tried to see where his memory would be perfect or imperfect. He had no motivation to lie because he knew they had the actual transcripts of the actual calls. That was the subject of the discussion. And then after that, because the original 302s, basically the original FBI interview notes from the agents at the scene said there was nothing wrong here, they had to go back and doctor those documents, edit them. Many of the original documents would disappear from the records and never be found. And so we have a bogus investigation, a pretextual investigation, an entrapment interview, followed up by doctoring documents to cover up what took place. And then they used conflicted counsel. Counsel for General Flynn had their own problems separate and independent of General Flynn, and used that conflict of interest to undermine General Flynn's defense. And then after that, hid all of this from General Flynn and his new defense team. So they hid the emails, they hid the documents, they hid the notes, they hid the records, all of it. Indeed, you could sort of say that we have some video footage of the approach to law enforcement badges that these particular police officers and federal law enforcement agents took and prosecutors took as it relates to General Flynn. Let's take a look at video clip number 4.
We are federalists, you know, the mounted police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Yes, indeed. They don't need to show lawful authority. They don't need no stinking badges. They just went about doing what they were going to do the way they were going to do it anyway. And this conforms to a range of behavior, especially when you tie it into Christopher Steele, who was a key participant in this entire Spygate coup attempt against the president, using the attack on General Flynn to try to achieve it and accomplish it, because General Flynn was such a protector of the president that he could have precluded and prevented it from moving forward. In that respect, there are two good books and films to review to understand the mindset, the template that these individuals and officials use. One is from Graham Greene, called Our Man in Havana. Our Man in Havana is based on Graham Greene's personal experience. He was a great literary writer, but he himself was actually a British spy during World War II in Africa. And he watched what German spies were doing. And he figured out the German spies were just making up their sources and making up their stories, because nobody knew otherwise up the food chain. That in fact, the spy game was a fake game, frequently and often the case by nefarious individuals. That they learned that all they have to do is just doctor a story. That in the same way Peter Strozik doctored a story against General Flynn, and Christopher Steele was doing the same against President Trump, is portrayed very well in a movie called Our Man in Havana, based on the book by Graham Greene. And we'll show you a clip from the trailer from that, from clip number 3. And the backstory, to give it away, is they go to a vacuum cleaner in Havana. They make him their man in Havana. And it turns out that he has to make everything up because he doesn't have any of the contacts they claim. Let's take a look at video clip number 3.
This is a top secret item, a map locating undercover activities. For each little pin here, there is one little spy. There, for example, our man in Jakarta, our man in Vienna, our man in Tokyo, and our man in Moscow. But the most unusual agent of them all was our man in Havana, a very likable chap in a most unlikely situation.
Frankly, when they asked me to be their man in Havana, I had no idea of how a spy spies. But I had reasons for being willing to learn, and they were anxious to teach me. That man is one of my instructors, a diabolical expert at the cloak and dagger game.
My name's Hawthorne. You will come to know me better as 59200. I'm in charge of the Caribbean Network.
It sounds like the Secret Service.
Look out, someone's coming. Slip into a cabinet. Mustn't be seen together.
We have been seen together.
Don't argue, man. I know the ropes.
Starring Alec Guinness, forced by accidents and design to become our man in Havana.
You again!
Burl Ives, caught up in the make-believe. Maureen O'Hara as a security secretary covering for our man in Havana. Ernie Kovacs, alias the Red Vulture.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I meant it for my whiskey.
This is the first time I've been shot in the back. I'm glad it was my woman.
Noel Coward, he placed our man in Havana. Placed him on the spot. Ralph Richardson, chief of security. Joe Morrow, our man in Havana's problem child.
I think we've got the Caribbean Network sewn up. Just put me in the picture. I think you'll find the West Indies over here, sir.
I always mix up the East and the West Indies.
Every time Carol Reed makes a picture, everyone looks forward to something special in screen entertainment. Every time Graham Greene writes a story, everyone expects out-of-the-ordinary excitement and suspense. Now this team, so famous for The Third Man, has come to Cuba, one of the world's headline danger spots, to film Our Man in Havana.
This is where you end up. Alone.
I was under orders. Like you.
The real secret in the film is that, in fact, he's inventing a lot of his stories just to get paid more and more money, because it's how the spy game really operates. It's how Chris Steele really operated. It's how Peter Strozik was in part really operating, though it has real world consequences, as that film depicts. Also, similarly, John le Carré, another spy who famously came in from the cold, did a similar film called Tailor in Panama, where basically the spy gets his inside source, who's just a local tailor, to invent crazy stories in order to get more money that also leads to real-world consequences. Let's take a look at video clip number two.
For the record, times, names, places, his actual words, if you can remember them, and goose it up a bit. This one's going straight to the top. Here we go. What kind of Chinese, by the way?
Like Chinese.
Oh, fuck's sake. I mean, mainland Taiwan.
Both landing, the two together, hand in hand. It's something the president's very proud of. And he's brought them both together, sitting at the same table. Harry says to me, if it's the only thing I'm remembered for, then so be it. I'm the one who brought reconciliation to the great Chinese people for the betterment of all mankind.
You've excelled yourself, Harry. This is a better yarn than Arthur Braithwaite.
You're implying that I'm...
Doesn't matter what I think.
Please.
First informants. Abraxas and Marta.
Installed?
Payment on results, Harry.
And the farm was such, Andy.
Well, looking good. Oh, look at those tits. Oh, yum, yum.
You want to pay off the debt? With what?
The Tailor of Panama famously portrayed the way the spy game often operates. You can just make up your sources. You can just make up your stories. You can just come up with pretext for any power grab you want. That's what Christopher Steele was doing. That was, in fact, what Peter Strozik was doing in trying to set up General Flynn. When we come back in the bottom half of the hour, we'll take your calls from you, the jury, as we see this pandemic-driven panic politics Flynn the world. Welcome back to American Countdown. We'll be taking your calls in this half of the hour. You can call in at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. Or internationally at 512-646-1776. 512-646-1776. In this 1984 world, this COVID-1984 world, where innocence is guilt and guilt is innocence, no case better exemplifies that than does the case of General Flynn. In a opinion piece written today by law professor Jonathan Turley, who mostly leans to the left and is more of an establishment institutional guy by nature and by history, he wrote a good piece called, entitled, Michael Flynn Case Should Be Dismissed to Preserve Justice. It was such a well-crafted piece, I'm going to read from it because it's worth reading from. Previously undisclosed documents in the case of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn offer us a chilling blueprint on how top FBI officials not only sought to entrap the former White House aide, but sought to do so on such blatantly unconstitutional and manufactured grounds. These new documents further undermine the view of both the legitimacy and motivations of these investigations under FBI former director Comey. For all of those who have long seen a concerted effort within the Justice Department to target Trump allies and associates, the fragments of these new discovered documents read like a Dead Sea Scrolls version of a deep state conspiracy revealing the deep truths within. One note from these FBI files reflects discussions within the FBI shortly after the 2016 election on how to entrap Flynn in an interview concerning his conversations with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, who, by the way, they already had the transcription of and knew everything about. According to the information, the note was written by the former FBI head of counterintelligence, Bill Priestap. Think about that. The head of counterintelligence. This is supposed to be the best of the best of the FBI, and they're busy spending all of their time trying to entrap General Flynn. After a meeting with Comey and his deputy director, Andrew McCabe. So the number one at the FBI, Comey, the number two at the FBI, Andrew McCabe, and the number three with Bill Priestap, head of counterintelligence, that's where these notes came from, was after that meeting and their discussion. The note states, quote, what is our goal? Truth and admission, or to get him to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired? This may have expressed an honest question over the motivation behind the targeting of Flynn, a decision for which Comey later publicly took credit when he told an audience that he decided he could, quote, get away with, quote, sending a couple of guys over, unquote, to the White House to set up Flynn and make the case. The new documents also explore how the Justice Department could get Flynn to try to admit to breaking the Logan Act, a law that dates back to 1799, which makes it a crime for a citizen to intervene in disputes between the United States and foreign governments, something that General Flynn wasn't even doing as a member of the transition team, couldn't even been accused of doing. And yet here they were trying to use a law that has never been used before in a criminal prosecution to get him implicated in something that couldn't have even been a crime by him in the first instance. This was also an idea of Sally Yates at the Justice Department. Indeed, in his role as national security advisor to the president-elect, there was nothing illegal in Flynn meeting with Kislyak. To use this abusive law here was, in the words of Professor Turley, utterly absurd. Although other figures, such as former Attorney General Sally Yates, also tried to use it. Nevertheless, the FBI latched onto this abusive law to target the Army General. Another newly released document in an email from FBI lawyer Lisa Page to former FBI Special Agent Peter Strozek, who played the leadership role in targeting Flynn. In the email, Page suggests that Flynn could be set up by making a passing reference to a federal law that criminalized lies to federal investigators. She suggested to Strozek, quote, it would be easy to just casually slip that in. So the effort was not about protecting national security or learning critical intelligence. It was about bagging Flynn, for this case, in a legal version of a canned trophy hunt. It is also disturbing that this evidence was only recently disclosed by the Justice Department. When Flynn was pressured to plead guilty to a single count of lying to investigators, he was unaware such evidence even existed and was unaware that the federal investigators who had interviewed him told their superiors they did not think Flynn lied to them when he was discussing the conversation. Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team changed all that and decided to bring this dubious charge. In the process, they drained Flynn financially while threatening to charge his son. He goes on to point out that Flynn was never charged with treason or with being a unregistered foreign agent, that the judge misinterpreted the government's records at the prior hearing and proceeding. And as he puts at the end, justice demands a dismissal of his prosecution. Whatever the goal may have been, justice was not one of them in prosecuting General Flynn. And this is coming from a more conservative, traditional, mainstream law professor. This is not someone prone to that kind of strong rhetoric and language. He's saying what happened to General Flynn is extraordinary. What happened to General Flynn is exceptional. What happened to General Flynn should never have happened and should never happen again. And the only way we can meaningfully take remedy is if heads roll at the FBI. That means that people like James Comey, people like Andrew McCabe, people like Lisa Page, people like Peter Strozek get to see what it feels like to be on the other side of a macroscopic, microscopic federal criminal investigation for their wide-ranging illicit activities in this effort, as there were other illicit activities in other aspects of the attempts to target President Trump and his allies. It also means that people like Roger Stone should be pardoned now rather than later. The evidence from the General Flynn case also impeaches and indicts the investigation of Roger Stone and the tampering that took place there. If you look at what happened there, there's all kinds of issues with the searches and all kinds of issues with how the case came about and its selective prosecution. But you have abusive venue selection in choosing to go to the District of Columbia. You have a judge who issues a gag order that prevents him from defending himself in the court of public opinion, a court order that denied the public's ability to know who the jury was. It could have exposed that jury bias even earlier and sooner than it was. And then you had jurors who were clearly biased, who were involved in the participation of the case, and a judge who was not interested in impartial, independent justice, but was interested in seeing Roger Stone convicted and sentenced and punished. His sentence today was postponed. His serving his sentence was postponed for 30 days, giving President Trump more time to act. But he should act sooner rather than later, because the travesty that took place in General Flynn's case is replicated in aspects of the Roger Stone case, and they all originate from the same poison tree of the Mueller investigation and the corrupt rogue agents at the FBI and at the Department of Justice, from Sally Yates to James Comey to Andrew McCabe to Lisa Page to Peter Strozek and to many of these wayward prosecutors who were involved in a case against General Flynn, and many of them overlap with the cases against Roger Stone, people that had a notorious history of problematic behavior in the way they've conducted investigations in the past. They were exemplified here, whether you're talking about entrapment, doctoring documents, hiding exculpatory evidence, coercing a false testimony, trying to create a false record. And I see some people saying, well, General Flynn pled guilty. General Flynn was coerced into pleading guilty by evidence being withheld from him and threats against his son and the bankrupting effect of the investigation against him. But something else is critical in that capacity. The reason why they hid that documents and information is they had gaslit General Flynn into believing that he had made inaccurate statements with some degree of intentionality that he didn't recall making. He said so at the time. But he's like, okay, they're telling me that their records and evidence show I made deliberately, that I made false statements, that I should have known better, that must have meant I did know better. Okay, I'll just, I can't continue to fight this by myself forever. And in fact, what happened is they gaslit him by withholding evidence that showed that they knew he did not make material misrepresentations to them with any degree of intentionality, that it didn't have any materiality on their case or investigation. It had nothing to do with what they were actually trying to do, which was entrap him. So you have entrapment. You have extortionate threats through the way in which they went after his son. You have them gaslighting him by doctoring documents and hiding information and evidence. If this is what's supposed to be custom and practice in the federal criminal justice process, then we need a complete purge of everyone who makes power decision makings in the federal criminal justice process, because it's abhorrent and makes a mockery of our constitutional liberties and the core freedoms that are supposed to be behind our criminal justice process. So let's go to some of your calls and your inquiries. Let's go to and hear from you. Let's go to G from Minnesota.
Hi. I had a question about class action lawsuits. So I'm here in Minnesota, and our archdiocese has not allowed us to go to Mass on Easter. And, you know, our governor just extended the stay-at-home order till like May 18th. You know, the way that these globalists are trying to destroy our country is by destroying our formal laws, by flouting those, and by trying to change our social norms. And the way that we need to fight back is through enforcing our formal laws and enforcing our traditional social norms. And so I'm fed up with this. I think that it makes sense to do like a class action for like hairdressers or whoever who can't actually do any like curbside pickup or whatever in Minnesota. And definitely for the Catholic Church, archdiocese by archdiocese, really kind of gathering together and forming a class action lawsuit against the archdiocese, who there's so many abuses. It wouldn't even just be the infringement on our religious freedom, but also all of these abuse scandals that they're misusing our funds for. When we put money into the collection plate, we don't expect it to be used to settle like abusive, crazy like priests, right? We're doing it. We put that money there for a particular reason. So it's complete, you know, misadvertising of what that money is for. We have to, like, so basically I'm trying to see from you, because I've been looking around for lawyers to help me with this. Different associates that I've spoken with have said that it's a good idea. It's a really interesting case, but they're associates, right? And honestly, I feel like just like a complaint letter would be enough to kind of have the governor and like an archbishop pay attention. I think that's the only language that they listen to when they're about to lose money or like face some sort of like, you know, criminal prosecution or like legal issue. And so, yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion on that and see if you have any recommendations of who I can go to for this.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling in. That definitely goes to the point. We're looking at bringing suits across the country. Free America Law Center is an organization I helped found is going to help support it. We're talking to lawyers all across the country. Other lawyers are bringing good legal actions in their local jurisdictions. And we definitely need a coordinated legal response to this onslaught of governors stealing people's basic core civil liberties and suppressing those civil liberties for dubious and questionable reasons. In this regard, for example, today, and Minnesota is behaving the same way as New Jersey, behaving similar as Connecticut, behaving similar as Massachusetts in certain respects, behaving similar to Maryland, behaving similar to Virginia, behaving similar to Illinois, where a court stepped in and actually intervened to protect the public. But now that case goes to the Illinois State Supreme Court. We'll see if they continue the trend of protecting the public or go the other direction, as a Michigan trial court judge did today. The California is talking about shutting down a bunch of beaches, which are, in fact, the lowest level of risk exposure that you could possibly have. Schools remain closed when there is no evidence that that provides any public purpose whatsoever, least of all a purpose that is narrowly tailored to a compelling public interest, which is the constitutional standard the governor of Minnesota, like all the other governors and mayors, is supposed to be abiding by. And there is simply inadequate evidence that either the compelling public interest justifies what they're doing or that this is in any respect narrowly tailored. Clearly, people can go to church and go to mass in a way that has limited exposure and risk to themselves. This virus mostly poses a risk only to those with comorbid conditions that are elderly, particularly in nursing homes. And if you think about it, the one area of risk that they knew about was to vulnerable elderly people with health compromised immunity systems, who this kind of virus would spread the worst in close confined quarters and with continuous contact with others in recycled air settings. So what did they do? They forced elderly people to stay in the nursing homes, locked them into the nursing homes, sent people that they knew had tested positive, like in New York, and apparently happened in other states too, sent them into those nursing homes to be with them where the air was going to be recycled, where there would be close continuous contact in these confined quarters of this most vulnerable population. They put them in a position where they were at most risk of being exposed to the virus and being at most risk of suffering the most debilitating consequences. That is not the sign of a sound or sage public policy. That is the sign of a power-mad politicians. And it's this pandemic of power madness that endangers our core constitutional liberties. And it is definitely the case we need more legal action, more civil disobedience, more public action to make meaningful remedy. We are trying to do what we can, and I'm trying to bring what suits we can in as many jurisdictions as we practically can for as many people as we can, working with local counsel in various jurisdictions across the country. I can appear on a pro hoc basis in various jurisdictions across the country. Obviously, Tennessee and California are my core home states, where I practice routinely, but I'm also licensed in a range of federal courts, and local counsel have volunteered to provide assistance, including we are looking at in Minnesota. In fact, in that regard, in Michigan, we're seeing the sort of mindset that's taking place. You would think that the governors would be more mindful that if people politically resisted in mass and that they had some of their coffers cut off, that they would be second guessing their strategies. But in part because they may be in cahoots, maybe colluding with some political and economic powers that be that see this as an opportunity for more power rather than less, it may be less of a concern than it would normally be with a rational governor or mayor. And this reflects the insanity that is taking place in Michigan. As this article is entitled, Michigan House does not extend the state of emergency, has to sue the governor, though, because she's going to continue to enforce one of the most inane and insane shutdown orders in the entire nation. It's the governor of Michigan that said you can go out in a boat and a kayak, but not if it has a diesel motor on it. The governor of Michigan who said you can't invite friends over or family over in your own neighborhood. The governor of Michigan, the would-be queen of Michigan, who said you can't travel between your own homes in your own state. It was the governor of Michigan who said you can't buy seeds or even an American flag. This is who the mindset is of the governor of Michigan. Reason why I have brought suit against the governor of Michigan already, and we are looking at replicating that suit in a range of other jurisdictions, including Maine, including Massachusetts, including New Jersey, including New York, including Connecticut, including Illinois, including Virginia, including more suits potentially in California, including Nevada, including Oregon, including Washington. It's extraordinary the number of cities, counties, and states that are routinely and flagrantly violating people's core civil rights and civil liberties long after the information about this virus has shown that their basis and premise of doing so is without meaningful merit. So the so we are continuing to take inquiries, continuing to help everyone we can. People can go to BarnesLawLLP.com, P as in Peter, and there's a contact form that you can send in information. We're trying to process as much as we can, try to help as many people as we can, and trying to get as much remedy as we can, coordinating with other legal counsel across the country, because I agree, you're definitely right. The only way to stop this is to resist this by every means necessary. So thanks for calling in. Let's go to Jefferson and Virginia.
Good evening, Mr. Barnes. Thanks for another week of great shows.
Thank you, sir.
Your guest tonight hit on the same topic I asked about last week, which is what do we replace our money system with? He was talking about a digital currency being possible or cryptocurrency or Bitcoin. I think we have a solution that's being suppressed from us. The Department of Energy has a technology that's proprietary, was developed in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. You should be proud of that. And it's called Lifter technology. It's liquid fluoride thorium reactors. So I think our money supply can be based on thorium as another metal, which is much more valuable than gold or silver, and it's much more abundant than either of those, and it becomes a nuclear fuel in this technology that only we have at the moment. I don't know when the Chinese are going to get it, but right now we have it, and we should base our economy and our monetary system on thorium as one of the three metals in our basket of currency bases.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's definitely a possibility. I think what you, and particularly in a Mad Max kind of world that this post-pandemic economy potentially presents, because in Mad Max, basically forms of energy became forms of currency, became forms of power. So anything that had additional utility, part of the utility always of gold has been the fact that you can use it for so many things, that it has practical application, not just that it has inherent value, not just a value as a means of barter or exchange. And so anything else that can add to that, that can increase that, that can enhance that or substitute for it, is a potential form of alternative currency, especially from the state's intentions to have a form of currency that that maximizes their control over ordinary and everyday people and their and the citizens of civil society. So I think the government's motivations and the central bank's motivations is not something that's actually practical, that's actually useful, that's actually could be universal. Their motivations are control-oriented, control-dictated. That's where we're seeing counterproductive, contrarian, and often irrational policies being propounded and proposed, because it does have a reason, it does have a rationality, it's just not to serve the benefit of the ordinary people today. That's why you're seeing the willingness to crush Main Street, the willingness to have all of these issues with the dollar domestically and internationally that appear to have sort of incalculable, intractable problems that are without easy remedy. Seeing problems where they're not able to create certain things in the economy that they appear to be intended to do, but maybe that's not really their primary or principal objective. Maybe it's to reshape the public economy in ways that favor the politically protected and in the end enhance and elevate the power of the state over the citizen. Maybe that's what the common coordination of these policies actually would reveal when we see the deeper patterns within. So the no doubt there's real ways that ordinary people have to think about ways to create means of exchange independent of and separate from state control. If we continue to go down this path of the state having using its control over the means of exchange to make it even more invasive and even more controlling of people's economic well-being and the expression of their everyday liberty. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Jim in Texas.
I got to tell you, I got to thank that last caller. That was a great bit of information, whoever he was. That's excellent. But 2 points, Robert. One is, I was listening to the California doctor's video that was played on the break, and when they said about staying at home would reduce our immune system, I wonder if there's actually been studies done that these guys know about. If we can keep them home for just this much time, then they will get that much sicker or they will be that much more subject to sickness. And then the second point was I saw a video where a guy had a set of what he'd created was playing cards. These were two PhDs. one Harvard, one I don't know where. And it was showing all the interlinking between Fauci and BRICS and all the rest of these guys with the companies, Merck, the patents. Fauci had a patent in 2018 on something that's likely going to be tied into a cure for this. They got their hands in our pocket. And to trust these medical profiteers with our future, they're going to bribe our government to give them control over our future. If we see a video like that, something that could be useful, can we send it to you? Where could we send it to? Where can the listeners send it to?
So yes, there's some contact links available at band.video that are available. There's comments you can place on there. People can join band. It doesn't cost anything. They can join band.video, make comments in there. We monitor those. And if you provide links, provide information, that's a way we can get access to that information to be able to share it with listeners. No question. If we take a look at chart number five and chart numbers, start with number five. When we dig into the records of the Clinton Health Initiative, we find that, in fact, a key contributor, it appears a majority contributor of the Clinton Health Initiative and its various activities around the world, turns out to be the Gates Foundation in recent years. So we see that same political pattern of well-connected parties using their economic influence to reshape the public agenda in a way that distorts the interest of the ordinary person. And as to your specific question, in the sort of gatekeeper control of information that's trying to take place here, there's been suppression of the studies and surveys that were done before this particular pandemic that talk about the most dangerous place for this pandemic is people being in close continuous contact and confined quarters with closed windows. And yet that is precisely what they ordered the most vulnerable people to go and do. So that tells you something about that. So that there has been studies and surveys that part of what is most risky related to this virus is in fact the very remedy they've been propounding. Can't go to the beach. The one place in the beach, that's where you see the chart that has all the information on it, and you can track it down for yourself, the Clinton Public Health Initiative, and find that the Gates Foundation was a key contributor and donor behind it all. So that's what's happening in the modern world today. We have a public policy that is deliberately and directly counterproductive. We're not allowing kids to go to school, not allowing people to go to the beach where the disease has the least chance of transmission, while sending old people back that have the disease back into nursing homes to spread it. This is not rational reason. This is a state power grab by power mad politicians who are the real threat that it continues to spread. So it's your resistance, our self-education, your self-education that can help keep the democratic dream in America alive.